everyone who's listening to this, this I don't want to call it an episode of Papa's Basement. It can be, but I'm hanging out with my improv teacher and my friend, dare I say.
You please do not presume or don't. Please feel free to presume that we are friends.
There you go. Yeah. My friend Sean Westfall, the owner operator of the Unified Scene Theater in DC. Sean has been on the show once before, I think about 6 months ago, something like that.
Yeah, 6 months ago. I think it was the best episode that you've ever had. Yeah,
definitely. The numbers were off the charts, and women mailed me their underwear. And men. It was unexpected.
Very cool.
You've got a gift, sir. But I bought a travel recorder, and I like using it. Damn thing cost me $350, and... Yeah. I decided to take it into Sean's house. He was gracious enough to let me record here with him.
We are here in what's known as my library.
Really? There are a ton of books.
Yeah.
And they're those kind of books where I'm like, I recognize the name of that book. I've read very few of them, but the box set of The Wire DVDs, that's where I'm...
That's the one people go to from first. Yeah,
that's where I'm an equal.
Oh, is that Somerset Maugham? Wait a minute. That's The Wire.
All of it.
Holy shit. That's awesome.
Yeah, so I just wanted to record with you, man, because I had been spending so much of my life the last year or so over at your theater.
I'm sorry about that. I apologize.
No,
there
it
are
was,
better ways to spend a year of your life.
It worked out well. It
you
was
know, the Peace Corps is a great. You know, you could do good for other people.
I've thought about that, and then I thought, but what about me? Like, you know, I'm a person. I can do good for me. And it's slowed down a bit lately. Mm-hmm. I haven't been there in a while. I don't think anyone's been there in a while.
That makes two of us. Yeah, I haven't been in a while as well. So.
And I wanted to talk to you about that and just talk about life in general. Just the depressed duo, we'll call it. Just a downer of an episode. That's why it's not exactly.
Wait. Which one of us is the sidekick then? I think I'm your sidekick then. This is
are
your
you,
show.
Man?
This is your show. That makes
that
me
is
the
a heady responsibility.
The sidekick of the depressed duo. Yeah.
Oh God, you're depressed, Robin.
That's right.
Depressed Burt Ward. So yeah, man, I wanted to talk to you first. The Unified Scene was an improv theater, still is, in DC.
Feel free to use past tense. Go ahead.
The Washington Redskins were a winning team. The theater for a long time was having shows every Friday, every Saturday. A lot of students, you know, would come through your classes, and then I think like anyone who's done improv or done really any sort of class that is in theory there to help you reach toward a dream, which might be long deferred. You come out of it and you're like, well, fuck it. Now that we've done the class,
right?
We're going. That was all that stood between me and making it happen.
And the standard rich and famous contract.
Exactly. That's so right. We're going to get those improv teams together.
Right.
We're going to start performing at this theater.
Right.
And really, especially for me, none of that shit happened. It's just impossible to.
If you want your money back, I will.
No, I loved the class. It's just again, this is a uncensored affair, and again, I don't really want to call it a Papa's Basement. I'll label it as such, but it's really just the two of us talking.
Sure.
I feel those things don't happen so much in DC. Like, we're a city when it comes to the arts where we're there for like lawyers, to do shit in their off time.
Yeah. Is that your question? Is that
there's no question here. My only question is when we're going to pause this piece of shit and smoke again.
Okay, cool.
If I had my druthers, we'd be recording in the goddamn courtyard and just smoking the whole time.
Yep.
Podcasting French style.
So, to take note of your points here, the theater slowed down, and there were personal reasons for that, as well as cultural reasons for that. And again, I please, listeners out there, we're going to ramp back up, but we're going to be a little our direction is going to be in a different direction moderately going forward. But yeah, to your initial observation, or to your first observation about or the overturesque observation you made about DC being about lawyers, yes And is are you asking like are you wondering how that affects what we're doing at the Unified Scene Theater? Or,
well, I think guys like you and me,
yeah,
we, especially you, who's walked the walk for a long time, but I at least pay lip service to this. We want to think of art and comedy, that kind of shit, as something profoundly meaningful to us and something, sure, that really is inherent to us, and it's something we want to produce and we want to see really take off.
Right.
And I think so many of the classmates here in D.C., and I'm not trying to shit on anyone because they have good lives. They go back to being like fucking doctors,
right,
with husbands and stuff,
right,
like that. Like,
right,
they're doing okay for themselves.
Right.
But they come into these classes and they're just there to let off steam. This isn't like people that make the trip to L.A. or New York, you know, make the pilgrimage, and then they're like,
right,
I'm doing Groundlings, you know, I'm doing a shit ton of Second City, and that's all I care about. These are just affluent people that want to throw around a couple bucks, and this is, you know, it'll be improv 101 one week, and then they're doing calligraphy the next.
No, and that's an accurate assessment of the kind of student that ends up not just in our classes, but in theater classes and writing classes and things like that here in D.C. People come to D.C. for different reasons than they actually go to New York or Chicago or L.A. or other headier media-saturated scenes. Theatrical and comedy scenes, which isn't to say, let's also keep in mind that, you know, I know a number of people who have since left DC. We can call it the DC sort of talent drain, who go to places like New York, Chicago, or LA, and let's just use stand up comedy or improv comedy as sort of like the reason that they're going. But many of them, and we should remember this, end up doing almost precisely what they would have been doing here in D.C. in those areas, and not making the kind of headway that they perhaps envisioned when they left.
And is that just the odds are shit period for anyone?
The odds are shit period, and also, I mean, sometimes you know, a very good friend of mine talks about how, you know, let's say
it's Will Ferrell.
It's Will Ferrell. He and I are very close. Talks about how you can go to New York City, and, you know, if you want to do improv, it's a cult there. You know, and that's what he loves about it. Like, he went to L.A. and he found the atmosphere, improv-wise, not to his liking, because people weren't doing it for the same sort of love of improv that they were doing it in L.A. The mm-hmm. reason they were doing it in L.A., according to him, was because, you know, they wanted to get this on their resume. Studied at UCB, which is a great brand to have on your resume. But also to have shows in which they would invite people from the industry to come see what they could do. So they were sort of using improv as a step towards a much larger platform, whatever that platform was, acting, getting into a movie, becoming a producer, him or herself, that kind of thing. Whereas, as my friend talked about it, you know, in New York, you can just go and just do improv, you know, five or six, you know, maybe that's exactly like two or three or four times a week, and you're perfectly okay with that. And you're perfectly okay, you know, getting an occasional voiceover gig, getting an occasional commercial, paying the bills that way. But he says there's a lot of people in New York City doing improv every night just because they love it. They really love it, and they're okay. Let me go turn off my Google device. I'll be right back.
Pardon. No, it's cool. For that, probably didn't pick up on Mike, but Sean was talking about how you can make money in improv, and his Google voice said, "Sorry, I cannot help you with that," and the timing was perfect. He's marched off to shut down his device now. I get what you're saying. I'll be honest, as long as someone is doing improv to truly get better at it, even if they have designs beyond improv, I have no qualms about that. Like, those people still sound, right, like they're taking it infinitely more seriously than a lot of people that I kind of came up with.
Yeah,
I get what your buddy just loves improv. And
right,
that's it.
And he's happy.
Yeah,
and there are a lot of people, and you know, and I'm friends with some of them on Facebook and or follow them on social media, and I see that they're doing the same exact thing, and as ambitious as they might have been, they're okay with it. They're okay with you know, being a part of that. So yeah, and I guess here's how we can draw an analogy between what's happening in New York, Chicago, L.A. versus what's happening in Washington. There are people who come to Washington with the idea that I'm going to get into politics, I'm going to spend 6 years on the Hill, I'm going to go get my law degree, and then I'm going to go to some district somewhere, my home district, and run for Congress and come back to D.C. As a member of the House or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to go work in Washington. I'm going to work on campaigns. I'm going to draw that big campaign 8 years down the road where I'm managing a campaign and, you know, build my national profile that way to where I am the next James Carville who gets called as a talking head on election night to talk about elections and things like that. Or I'm going to go to Washington, D.C., make my bones in journalism and end up, you know, building a platform for myself to where I am a frequent commentator on CNN in the political realm, whatever. And there are multiple paths that you can take in Washington, D.C. But some people come to D.C. and with those ambitions, maybe they wrote them down and, you know, in their second year of college in a poli sci class, who don't end up doing that and who are just as happy working as a lowly, not a lowly staffer, but as a staffer for a member, just as happy working for an issues oriented NGO or nonprofit here in Washington, D.C., who, you know, for other reasons, for whatever those reasons are, set those ambitions aside and live here and eat, sleep, and raise a family here in Washington, D.C. So I think that, and again, that's the kind of people that we tend to get in our classes, and not just my theater, but all over the place. But for every, you know, for every two or three names in any sort of realm or industry or culture, you know, there's hundreds of people who are content to work as support, to further whatever goals, to get a paycheck, to live the life that even they themselves didn't envision when they were young. God knows that I'm glad that I don't have the goals, that I'm still not pursuing the goals that I had when I was, you know, 20, 23, 24, 25, 26. Because I realize now that I wouldn't have been happy.
What were those goals?
I think if you'd asked me what my dream job was about 15, 20 years ago, it would have been as a writer, a comedy writer, in the writer's room on The Simpsons, in the writer's room in SNL, I would have been okay.
You had quite a career.
I'm sorry?
I said you had quite a dream career.
Well, but I mean, do me a favor. Name five writers for SNL right now. Can you name them?
Oh, I couldn't name shit on that.
I couldn't tell you
the star of SNL right now. Is Lorne still there?
Who knows? Yes, he's listening right now. In the realm of, you know, what we envision as a career in comedy, that's kind of humble. I mean, I would have been okay, you know, if I'd been a sitcom writer of some play, just having, you know, my name in the credits as one of the 10 writers for the sitcom.
I think that's a great goal. I would kill for that now.
Right. I mean, nobody thinks about that. You know what I mean? It's you know what it's like? It's like going to your high school guidance counselor and saying, well, I want to be a policeman. And your high school guidance counselor says, yep, I understand you want to be a policeman. But do you know that there are all these other careers that are in the realm or universe of policemen, of first responder? Did you know that you could be a dispatcher? Did you know that you could be a paramedic? Did you know that you... So I think that, and I'm sort of getting off topic here, and I apologize. My blood sugar is low.
That's the show.
um, uh, um, um, I think that sometimes we think of that, you know, we get frustrated with ourselves because we think of this is what that career looks like, or this, God damn it, I'm not pursuing the goals that I had when I was younger. But that's okay. I mean, you know, I think that it's okay to be happy simply doing improv in New York City. It's okay to be happy, you know, working for, you know, normal here in Washington, D.C., even though your goal might have been to be a congressman. It's perfectly okay to understand that, you know, that your journey is distinctly your journey, and that, you know, you just because you didn't meet the goals that you articulated for yourself when you were younger doesn't mean that you're a failure, and doesn't mean that you aren't entitled to a bit of happiness when it comes to that. I mean the only and this is why it sort of stands out as an example. You know when Bill Clinton was a representative from like Boise State, or the Boise student, you know every year the high school elects their representatives to the national like youth congress or whatever. Okay. When he was 16, he was one of the people who came from Arkansas and got to meet President Kennedy. At 16 years old, he wrote down, "I am going to be president of the United States." After that simple meeting, there's a famous photograph of him, young Bill Clinton, 16 years old, shaking John Kennedy's hand. No doubt
that.
Talking to, "Hey, where's the ass here in Washington, D.C.?"
Yeah.
But my point is, we know that story because it's such an anomaly. I mean, when I was 16, I wanted to my primary interests were women masturbating,
yeah,
and figuring out what girls want.
I was gonna say I wanted to fuck Jenna Jameson at 16.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I have $5,000, so I guess I could.
So
make it
I mean,
happen.
More power to him for being that goal oriented at that age, and fulfilling that. You know, life comes at you fast, as the, is it State Farm, I think, commercial says, and you don't really, you don't really, you know what you shouldn't be beholden to the goals that you articulated for yourself when you're younger. Is it the long-winded way of saying it's okay, you know?
It's okay to fall short.
It's okay to fall short of goals. Well, and it's okay to fall short of goals that you yourself didn't realize what the cost would be to fulfill them, or it's okay to fall short of goals when you are simply trying to. You know, there are all kinds of circumstances in everyone's life. There's where we don't see what the challenges are. You know, to include illness, financial difficulties, you know, loss of life, you know, loss of family members. Being blindsided by, you know, a relationship when you were young. All kinds of stuff happens.
No, you're right. I mean, we like to think we're completely in control of our destinies, but we're really...
Oh, my God, we're not.
We're like those little baby turtles emerge from the egg pit, and
right.
Like 90% of them are just gull food.
Yeah, they don't make it. Yeah.
They're all adorable, marching toward the sea.
And then conversely, I mean, you know... What's the old saying? I think
life sucks.
Well, besides that one, okay. I think it was the Greeks who said this, they who the gods wish to torture first make famous, and you know, I mean, there's popular culture is rife with stories of people who made it relatively young. Made it relatively, you know, made it successful, and who either A, turned their back on that, or who B, realized that the intrapersonal costs of that were far too much and turned their back on that.
Are you talking about your friend Will Ferrell?
I'm talking about my friend Will Ferrell, okay. Who's obviously second guessing every choice he made in life. The perfect example. Do you see that recent documentary with Jim Carrey?
Yes.
I mean, it's a fascinating documentary. And here's a guy who basically said, I could have had it all. I could have.
He did.
Well, he did.
Let's be honest.
He did, right? Relatively speaking, he. But And again, if he really wanted to, if he could put his career in the hands of someone who could make sure that happens again. But it's pretty apparent that he had it, and he didn't want it anymore.
At some point, he burned out on it. I mean,
what burned out seems to be a placeholder for a series of circumstances, a series of realizations where he said, the cost is way too much.
I don't know. I think there were some middling years there where he might have still wanted fame and crapped out stuff like the number 23.
Right.
And now we've got another decade of perspective where he's like, okay, cool, I'm done with it now, and I'm happy with that.
Right. But I mean, I think the mistake we're making is we're assuming that he was in complete control of that project.
Yeah.
That you know, and this is something that people don't realize as well. You know, the person who's in complete control of any sort of creative endeavor is a rare entity. There are choices made for you, even though you are the artist and creator, that are completely out of your hands. If you're a musician, if you're you're beholden to a studio, you're beholden to an audience, you're beholden to a number of things. If you're an actor, if you're a writer, if you're in the room, you'd be surprised at the number of people, hundreds of people, who make decisions that affect your career. One of the great career mistakes, and people, you know, sort of attacked her for this when it happened, right after Halle Berry made the
Catwoman.
Before that movie, she made the movie where she's with Billy Bob,
Monsters Ball.
Monsters Ball, right? She won an Academy Award for that. Mm-hmm. The very first movie she made after that was
Catwoman,
a piece of crap. But the only reason she made it was because the studio said, "You need to make this movie." Like, she, in many cases, she wasn't even in control of that, and it almost, and for a long time there, it made her, persona non grata. It just destroyed her career.
Yeah, she had the stink on her for a while.
Yeah,
she's just literally famous for still being like bangable as shit at 55. Or
right, 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 right. But I mean, you'd be surprised how little control you have.
Yeah, good point.
Over anything, whether you're a creator or not, you just. The Lin-Manuel Mirandas of this world are rare. You don't get to be that
There's
person.
Tons of Puerto Ricans, dude. Need to go to New York.
So I don't think that I think that we should stop beating ourselves up for that. I keep going back to that, and I apologize for that. Your listeners are going to get completely your readers.
That's a really
because
big
there
deaf
are people
fan base.
Because they have to transcribe this and read it. So and if I sound like I'm taking myself way too seriously in this, please just stop.
Dude, we're sitting in your damn library just shooting the shit.
Punch me in the balls.
No, that would involve getting up. I'll throw something at you. I'm such a blue-collar shit lump, by the way. You brought up that Jim Carrey thing.
Right.
Which, again, on Netflix, I forget what it's called, Andy and Jim.
Andy
or something
and Jim,
like
yeah.
I remember seeing him completely in character and running amok on that set, and the entire time I'm just like, the poor fucking hair people.
Right.
Like, the fucking secretary, like, he's in character as, like, whoever the fuck, Tony Clifton or something, screaming to see Steven Spielberg.
Right.
And I'm like, the poor goddamn secretary who's torn between, like, do I acquiesce to goddamn Jim Carrey or do I guard, George?
this is the thing that we often forget about when it comes to these artifacts of culture that get produced. I mean, Jim Carrey, I'm sure he recognizes that he was putting millions of dollars and careers of other people at risk when he did that.
Yeah.
I mean, let's leave the suits and the producers out of it. Fuck those guys. But I mean, there are people who, the hairdresser who got that gig, who's trying to crap out a living in L.A.
Yes.
And, if his behavior had become more erratic, someone might have said, pull the plug, shut it down. Which means that the hairdresser, the craft services, the trailer people, there are people in LA whose job it is to haul trailers back and forth.
Yeah, that's it.
The sets,
that's
right?
It for them.
So I think that, you know, there are millions of dollars and hundreds of jobs at stake when stuff like that happens.
That's why I have mad respect, even if I'm not completely in love with Heath Ledger's Joker. And I know everyone else thinks that's like the pinnacle of acting the last 10 years.
Right.
Well, the lowbrow feel that way. But the dude, as soon as they yelled cut, was just out of character, bear hugging people.
Right.
Fucking like smoking offset with the key grip. You know what I mean? Like just a chill dude.
And this is something else that often gets ignored. And I sound like I'm talking like some sort of a Hollywood insider, but if you pay attention enough to the dynamics of that industry, you know that the people who get a lot of work are the people who are like nice to be around, people who people want to work with, right? Right. You know, if Brendan Fraser, you know, the our generation's Doug McClure, the B movie actor of our generation, if he were in any way a horrible human being, he would not have gotten as much work as he did.
Yeah, we wouldn't have Mummy 7.
Exactly, right. Right. Because people would just like, I'm not gonna fucking work with that guy. Yeah, I can't do it.
Yeah, I read something on him not that long ago. Actually, yes,
he was in Esquire magazine.
Yes, that was it.
Big huge interview with him.
And he talks about his horse, whose name was Pecus. And then he laughed to no end. Oh shit, that was a good interview. Going back to the theater, man.
Sure.
So much of what you describe in terms of finding a scene where you can perform, and even if it's not going to get huge for you, that makes you happy. That's what I had there. For a time where I was at your place post breakup, and I used to have a ritual of going to my girlfriend's and not getting laid every Friday night. And instead I drove 45 minutes to yours to not get laid. But at least I was on stage and I was doing something that really meant a lot to me. And I feel that's where DC completely falls short, where what you described, I'd be happy as a pig in shit if I could do improv 5-6 nights a week in this hood and do my dinky lock crap during the day.
Right.
Like, I would survive. Country boy can survive, I believe.
Country boy can survive. Yes. Hank Williams Jr.
Yeah, him, Herodotus, same shit.
Right. Like,
so, that's what kind of broke my heart, that the theater's been having, you know, it's slowed down. And I think on some level we're laughing about it now, but that has to hit you too, because you came into the city with the best of intentions, and you're trying... You have so many students you see who come out of your classes fired up as shit.
Right.
They really like, screw it. We're going to make our own troops. We're going to perform. We're going to perform here.
Right.
And so little, I don't want to motherfuck here, and I might be talking out of turn, but so little of that came to pass from them. And
yeah, well, I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, I think that our ambitions when it came to the theater, and it's probably something that I've bored you with before, but our ambitions when it came to the kind of content, and I use that word, I'm sorry, I apologize.
No, you're a content creator.
I'm not a content creator. I'm a content facilitator. I turn a key. Our goal was to say, look, there's fantastic improv being done in this city. There are a bunch of talented people. We're going to showcase that, meaning that we're going to... Any other stage in the city, a show would consist of like 3 to 4 improv troops, getting about 20 minutes each, and the improv would be sort of what I call improviser facing. It would be I call it one randomly named long form improv troupe after another, right?
Yeah,
you know, we're the Hell's Bells.
We're Hugs for Judy.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And we're gonna do some long form improv for you, right? Oh, good. Right.
I only watch Armando.
And the reason I can be jaded about that is because I used to be that guy too.
I was going to say, you've been in it 20 years. I'm a fucking locksmith that started class 18 months ago.
Right. So, our goal was to say, look, we want to curate good shows, quality shows, and also that we want to give troops who are talented a lot of time. And not only that, pay them. And we thought that model would be something that would attract a lot of improvisers.
No, it was a very... I want to say it was idealistic. It was pretty much a we will build it, they will come type thing.
Right. But what we discovered is improvisers, at least for the most part right now, don't care about that. That they, what they want is stage time, and what they'll, and they'll take it wherever they can get it. And if they can't get it at our theater, and again, because we were limiting ourselves to two troops, sometimes three, but in most cases, two troops a night on weekends, they weren't getting at our theater. So they would just use our theater as sort of a monthly stop on their tour of independent and other theaters here.
And it was your big belief is that if they're giving it away 10 times a month, someone's seen them for free at any, like a pancake house nearby.
Exactly. And or what they would do is they would say, okay, well, I'm in this troupe and I'm going to perform at the Unified Scene Theater this week. Mm-hmm. But I'm also in two or three other troupes who are going to be performing at various other theaters. Well, if you're seeing that on social media, you're seeing X troupe performing at blank place, free. X troupe performing at blank place, free. This troupe performing Unified Scene Theater, $15. Well, yeah. if you're this guy's friend and you want to, or a friend of two or three people who might be in that troupe or who might be in the same troupe they're performing at, or, you're not stupid. You're going to go, you know, see your buddy that you work with for free at one of these.
You're like,
schools.
Hey, dumb sluts, why not be prostitutes?
That's, and they're right,
like,
right.
We just want to suck and fuck.
Right. So that's sort of what we were running into as well. We were running into that, and it hurt us. We should also keep in mind that it's not. I can't lay the blame at improvisers who want to get better and are seeking out ways to get better, because the only ways I know how to get better are to take classes and get up on your feet and do this. So you can't fault them for that. But the other cultural challenge that we were running into and are still running into, and, you know, we'll know a few months from now whether or not we've solved it, is that almost every space in DC, bar, non-bar, brick, black box theater space, is featuring free comedic content right mm-hmm. now. I've been joking around over the last couple of months that I have a theory that a bar is going to open in D.C. on 14th Street or on U Street, and they're going to advertise 100% comedy free. A comedy show, we promise, a comedy show
steal the pop
will not break
slogan.
Out on a random Tuesday or Wednesday night to kill your buzz when you're trying to watch the fucking Caps game. We promise this will not happen. Name a bar in D.C., name a space in D.C., and chances are that they are featuring either A, an open mic, or B, not just bars, you know, coffee shops. They're either featuring having an open mic night, or they're featuring an improv night once a month or perhaps twice.
I don't know
a month.
What you're saying too. It's a
and
mixed
that, and
space
that,
thing.
Yeah, and that hurts.
Yeah,
that hurts the people who are trying to privilege improv comedy and treat it like, you know, the valuable commodity that it is.
Now, is that,
and it also lowers the expectations for improvisers.
Are you in a New York and L.A., Chicago, is that not so much a thing? Like, most of these are paid shows and people...
No, probably not. Okay. Most of these are not paid shows. But I think that in those spaces and places, they generally have a reputation for being the place where that's also a training ground for mm-hmm. comedy. I don't want to tar and feather, you know, the D.C. bar and restaurant and coffee scene for being smart and saying, look, there's a bunch of people who are hungry to get up on stage, and I have a bar to run, and it's a highly competitive industry. I mean, in the time that we started this podcast, three bars just opened up in Washington, D.C.
Shit, that is impressive.
So I got to get something to get foot traffic in. So I'm, look, you know, hammer, meat, and nail. This is going to happen, right? I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity. But, you know, in places like New York and Chicago and L.A., there's sort of...
Sorry, I at first heard hammer, meat, nail, and I thought that was you just doing another shitty improv group name.
Hey, everyone, we're hammer, meat, nail. I'm a hammer and we're the nail. That's even a horrible takeoff on that. So, yeah, I think that that's the challenge we're running into, too, is that every black box theater space, every coffee shop, every restaurant is offering free content just to increase foot traffic. You know, the improvisers aren't making money off that. They're doing it for free. It's the bar that's making money. And I guess I thought that improvisers would be a little more sensitive to the theaters that are privileging it.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't venture out into those areas, into those spaces as frequently as they have been, to the point of they're actually producing shows in those spaces. So,
shit.
And you know, and we were pretty open. It's like, if you have an idea for a show, let us know, reach out to us. We'll talk to you. And they haven't been doing that. And you know, I don't think our space is that bad. You know,
I like it.
And not only that,
I fixed the toilet.
Thank you. But not only that, but if you know, we would pay you for that. We would, it wouldn't be much, mm-hmm. but it's certainly more than some bar or coffee shop is going to pay you. So I don't know. I don't know. We tried it, and you know, just like Richard Wright titled his memoir of his fascination with communism, it was the God that failed. It's the God that failed.
Fair enough, man. Yeah. I want to applaud you for giving it a shot. Christ knows I've barely done that. I've taken some classes. I haven't taken that plunge. I don't know what the plunge would be for me at 37. At 37, it all sounds very stupid.
I think that you should keep going. Keep persevering. And I'm saying this earlier to you when we got on hot mics. Hey everyone, we're hot mics.
That was the name of the mock radio show that Pete and I, and I, if you wanted in on the mix too,
right?
I think we had pitched that as a show, but the theater's kind of slowed down a bit. But we were thinking of either doing live events with Papas or doing an improv
anytime
structure.
You want. The door is open anytime.
Alrighty.
You want.
I want Wednesday at noon.
You know, and this is also maybe my fault. It probably is partially my fault for not communicating to people out there that if they had an idea for a show, we definitely want to. It's right there on our website. I mean, it's right there. It's like, you got an idea for a show? For God's sake, we want to hear it. I think our only requirement.
I don't know what a website is. I only do Snapchat.
Oh, okay,
I'm
cool.
22.
Yeah, nobody
I'm
does.
Young.
We do apps now, Sean. Yeah. You old man. Yeah, I think you keep persevering. I think you just keep going. You know, you were sitting here in my library with tons of books here, and some of them literary biographies. And if literary biography, and I've read a lot of literary biography, and it's in the lives of writers and the lives of artists, it fascinates and compels me. Primarily because I think when I was younger, I was looking for a model.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was older, as I've gotten older, I've sort of discovered that the model isn't transferable as analogous as we hope it is, because you never really know what, you know, the path to getting one of these books published is fraught with all kinds of disaster, and the lives that artists and writers lead. And let's leave aside, you know, the sort of pathologies that might be in place when it comes to being a writer and artist, to include, you know, addiction or a wound of some sort. You know, we just really don't understand. Sometimes the art and the success around that art happens for reasons that you just simply cannot fathom. You have no idea why these things happen. And you have no idea how, despite the challenges that these artists that were inherent in the lives of these artists, how the art got completed. It's a fucking mystery sometimes.
All right, keep grinding, and maybe something like Slumdog Millionaire-esque happens for me.
You never know. You absolutely
fair.
But I mean, it's not going to happen if you're not doing it.
Okay.
Whatever the circumstances are, it's not going to happen if you're not creating something.
So like my UCB 201 class, I'll be there, and somehow they'll pluck this diamond in the rough. And
maybe, you never know.
All right.
Or you might meet some guy who maybe you're having a shitty time in UCB 201, and you meet some guy who feels the same way, and he says, "Hey, I'm doing this."
Next thing you know, I'm a white slave trader.
That's how it happens. It's a short series of steps towards that. Speaking of slave traders,
yes,
Arthur Rimbaud.
Is that our new group?
That's yes, slave traders. Arthur Rimbaud. That Arthur Rimbaud wrote most of his poetry when he was young. he wrote A Season in Hell when he was like 17, 18, 19. Turned his back on poetry in his mid-20s and became a gun runner and a slave trader. Did you know that?
No.
And again, what do we remember Arthur Rimbaud for? Not for the gun running and the slave trading, but for the stuff.
This is where I can tell you're far more well-read than me. But, I'm like, do you want some Andrew McCarthy here?
But for the stuff that he wrote when he was ambitious and young and not jaded, that's what we remember him for. And I'm going to bore your listeners with tons of literary biography. So before Einstein, the leader.
I know him.
Okay. So before Einstein, the leader in the realm of physics was Sir Isaac Newton.
Sure.
Isaac Newton, right? And
makes a mean cookie.
And Newtonian physics was based on the Principia Mathematica.
Yes.
Which Newton wrote, I think it's late 20s, early 30s, he may have written this, right? Newton had to be encouraged by his friend. By the way, that's where we get the three laws of motion, right? Three laws of motion, right?
Okay.
Newton wrote this and just set it aside. Like, he didn't even feel compelled to publish it. Like, he was like, okay, I have this thing over here. His real fascination and compulsion, he was a deist, and he would root through the Bible, because he was certain that there was a numeric, and I'm probably not doing justice to the whole theory, but he was certain that there was that the numbers and verses of chapters of the Bible, and the numbers that are referenced in the Bible could be decoded in a way that only he was fascinated by numbers to begin with. That's where he spent a lot of his energies.
Good
on.
Lord!
And his friends had to say, Ike, look, that's all well and good, but this is what he had. His friends finally encouraged him to publish it, and that's what we remember him for. Even artists don't realize the value of their own products and their own talents and their own capabilities. They really don't. If literary biography has taught me that, it's that writers themselves are oblivious to what they themselves are good at, where their strengths are, whatever. My point is, persevere, keep going, because you don't know. You have no idea. You have no idea what's going to happen to you, and you have no idea what posterity is going to remember you for, other than, in your case, like the realms of porn that you have stacked.
I was going to say, maybe a presidential assassination at some point.
Don't say that.
I didn't say which one. It's perfectly legal. We might have Hitler bot in 2420.
That's true.
You don't know. Well, shit, man. I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't. I've got nowhere to... No, we can take this anywhere we want. I feel like we kind of blew our wad if you want to just go and have more cigs, but we can keep talking, too.
This is your show, man. I'm a caboose on this train, my brother.
I am happy to have done this, and we should do... You know what? Fuck it. Let's wrap this one up.
Okay.
And we can do more in the future because this is painless, right? Bringing a little travel kit. Well, everyone, that is Sean Westfall of Unified Scene Theater. And you'll be hearing more of him because I want to get my goddamn money's worth out of this travel kit. It's like $500 worth of parts here. I'm doing something with it. You don't buy the $200 pocket pussy to not bang it. That's what I'm saying. Sean, people can do unifiedscenetheater.com to actually see the theater's site. And
right.
If you're in the DC area, the DMV,
yep.
Come out and see some shows.
Mm-hmm.
You're at Sean Westfall on Instagram and Twitter?
Yep, exactly. Both of those, yeah.
And I don't know, man. I had fun. I always, I like
oh,
coming
and,
from the
and we're also at Unified Scene DC on Instagram and Twitter as well.
Follow both.
Yep, cool.
And that was... I'll be honest, that was something that, keep grinding yourself, man.
Yeah.
I got to say, I loved seeing those posts go up every Friday and every Saturday night on Instagram showing the theater and whoever's performing. It was just something I look forward to. I'm still not getting your damn mail list, by the way.
I will add you to the mail list.
I don't know. I was on that. I got to check. It's not on my spam filter. But come out and take the classes. I got to say, you're the, it's through you that I actually take this shit seriously, and now I'm like wasting my money going to UCB in New York.
I don't think it's a waste of money, but
I but if you're serious about comedy, Sean's a dude to get in touch with and who will, you know, get you focused and keep you fired up for it, I guess. Despite what we did here, I'm inspired. I'm more inspired than anything. The Newton stuff got me.
It always does.
Right at the end.
You know, sometimes when I don't have an audience in my pocket, I bring out Isaac Newton references.
Yeah.
Boom. They're right in the palm of my hand. So.
I'm John Papagiorgio. It's Papa's Basement. And again, you'll be hearing from Sean shortly. And hopefully we'll be doing some sketches at some point.
So absolutely.
That's really where my focus is turning. There's this new thing called YouTube.
What?
And I think it could be really instrumental in getting me something.
That's crazy talk.
All right, buddy.
All right, man.
Later.